Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why white working class voters rejected Hillary Clinton and voted for Donald Trump, and speak with Joan Williams, Distinguished Professor of Law and Founding Director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. We will discuss her article at the Harvard Business Review, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class, and analyze why Democrats have concentrated on race and gender issues and not addressed the concerns of the working class, and assess the risks of America's continued class cluelessness in not bridging the class culture gap that is likely to turn dangerous when it becomes clear that Donald Trump will not bring jobs in steel back to Youngstown, Ohio. Then we'll speculate on the likely choices for the top cabinet posts, Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury, and look into the resume of the frontrunner for Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, who served as the Trump campaign's chief fundraiser and was an investment banker on Wall Street who profited from foreclosures following the 2008 housing crash. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, who was previously chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, joins us to discuss what the combination of a Wall Street insider chosen by the alleged outsider and Paul Ryan's Ayn Rand economic agenda will mean for the average American. Then finally, we'll assess whether the murderous, foul-mouthed Filipino President Duterte has gone too far following his lightning romance with the Chinese after having insulted the U.S. president and the head of the U.N. and threatened to kick the U.S. out of the Philippines. Alfred McCoy, the chair of history at the University of Wisconsin and author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, joins us. We will discuss the impact of the repudiation of Duterte by his mentor and former president of the Philippines, General Fidel Ramos, who recently resigned as the country's special envoy to China after blasting his former protege in the press. And joining us now is Joan Williams, a distinguished professor of law and founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. She has an article at the Harvard Business Review, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Williams.
Delighted to be here.
And it is a pretty extraordinary thing that the Democratic Party failed to win over the white working class, particularly the men, and that they lost in the Rust Belt, a traditional Democratic stronghold. What explains this? I mean, it's absolutely an epic failure on the part of the Democrats.
Well, you know, they not only lost white working class men, they also lost white working class women by 28 points. If white working class women had split 50-50, Clinton would have won. The Democratic Party had an absolute command of white working class votes from about 1940 to about 1970, and then has lost them off and on ever since. Now, some Democratic Party candidates, notably Bill Clinton, brought them back in, but many of them did not. And in fact, there are some press reports that suggest that Bill Clinton was lobbying hard to go to the Rust Belt and talk the language of the white working class guys, and that he was told not to do so, that that was outdated, that they were no longer part of the Democratic coalition. And
well,
there's the tragedy.
Well, yes, indeed. They, just like Al Gore, kept the big dog on a leash. So did Hillary Clinton keep her husband on a leash. He apparently was furious. And he saw this coming some time back and simply wasn't listened to. It's an extraordinary turn of events to have...
But there might be some reasons not to listen to Bill Clinton. He has occasionally been irritating, but
right.
Moving on.
Yeah, but let's face it. He's a skill campaigner. And frankly, I think he's more in touch with the very people that we're talking about. He grew up very poor in Arkansas and speaks the language of the very people who the Democratic Coalition have lost.
He's a political genius, and he's also a white working class boy. But I think that, you know, the bottom line is Hillary would have won if she hadn't been a woman, too. There were a number of things. This was a very close election. there are a number of things that that led to a very close election that she lost. But I think the moment of opportunity for those of us who identify as Democrats and progressives is to think about why Trump, who has so many flaws as a person and as a candidate, was so successful at connecting with a key constituency in the United States that by many, many standards should be voting Democratic because they are not part of any elite. And I think that what we see is that the white working class, which became disillusioned by the Democrat, the progressive elite around 1970 and remains disillusioned, is now equally disillusioned with the business elite that has been the core of the Republican Party. And that they are now so disillusioned that they feel that all that's left them is the ecstasy of anger. And I think that that's a very dangerous situation because Trump, I suspect, will not be bringing good blue-collar jobs back to Youngstown, Ohio. And so when the white working class, which has suffered so acutely since 1973 in terms of the plummeting wages of white working class men, when they become disillusioned with Trump, I really fear for what is going to happen next. So that's why I'm really urging Democrats and progressives to think hard about an axis of social disadvantage they traditionally have not thought about much. And race is a very important axis of disadvantage in the United States. Gender is another one. And social class is a third one. And we as progressives have really focused on gender and race, I think, in very searching and thoughtful ways and made put a huge amount of imaginative energy into connecting across difference when it comes to gender and race. I'm afraid we put very little intellectual firepower and emotional energy in connecting with these white working class voters.
So when you said a minute ago, Joan Williams, that part of the reason that Hillary Clinton lost was that she's a woman, that in itself is pretty depressing since so many other countries have had women heads of state and we have yet to break the glass ceiling here in the United States. What has that to do with what you refer to in your article as manly dignity, and that manly dignity is a big deal for most men? So is breadwinner status. Many still measure masculinity by the size of a paycheck. I understand that 45% roughly of U.S. households are now headed by a woman who is the principal breadwinner.
Well, it depends on how you count, for sure. But the fact is that social ideals change very slowly. And the fathers of many white working class men supported their families with the family wage, with a wife that earned, who worked only part-time or intermittently. And that's no longer true for many white working class men. In fact, they often, if they lose a high-paying blue-collar job, their only alternative is working at McDonald's. And I think it's the Democrats and the progressives have been so focused on the social safety net. And, of course, I'm a Democrat and a progressive. I think the social safety net is super important. But I have been struck by the cluelessness of people who say, I don't understand why Clinton lost the white working class. She had things like family leave. She had things like the minimum wage that would have benefited them. I mean, that is, I'm afraid, ignorant on a number of different levels. First of all, there's a difference between the bottom third of American families, the poor, and the middle class that we're really talking about, the middle 50%. With a median income of $64,000. That's the group that I'm talking about. And that group does not want jobs at McDonald's for $15 an hour instead of $7.50 an hour. That group wants good, jobs that can support a family. And what the Democrats have not been, they've not been very interested in that. They've supported these trade deals that increase GDP without much attention to what happens to the guys who are working in the industries that move abroad. And that they have talked about college education. And look, I'm a professor. I understand college education is important. But I also understand that 75% of the people in this country do not have a college degree. And they, and many of them, they don't really want a college degree. What they would be far more interested in is a few years of college or post-high school education that gave them technical training to give them a good blue-collar job. And so look what Germany has done. Germany, if you want a good pair, a great pair of scissors, you buy German. We didn't do that. We didn't do that. And the fact is, I think that we have to understand that the professional elite, of course, we're obsessed with college and law school and all the rest of it, but that is not where many Americans are. They do not want their kids to be anthropologists. They want their kids to have a good, solid, settled life in a blue-collar job. And the Democrats never spend 3 seconds. That's an exaggeration. But they don't spend much time really focusing on that 75% of Americans who don't want a college degree. And what is the quality of their lives going to be like?
Well, unfortunately, though, I think to some extent, when you make the German comparison with trade schools, which they have in most advanced democracies, we do, have a set a premium on the Ivy League and tend to ignore community colleges and defund them. But one of the reasons we're defunding community colleges is because of the corruption in Washington with campaign finance and our money-driven politics. The most outrageous scam of all has been the $40 billion of taxpayer money that goes to these for-profit colleges, which are just rackets. And, of course, Donald Trump's university was among that group.
Yeah,
and that's a bipartisan scandal. Both Democrats and Republicans participate in this scam.
It's true. It's tragic. And it's an example of how this election was not about facts. It was about anger. It was about the fact that Trump provided a mind meld for people who were extremely angry at the elites because he's always been rejected by the elites. He's not a boy from New York City. He's a boy from Queens, where the New York elite has always rejected him. And so people are mystified at what Trump offers. It just seems to me crystal clear. The white working class figures, nobody is actually offering them a way out economically. But what Trump offers is the dignity of listening to them, the dignity of understanding and channeling their anger. And if progressives want to win back the white working class, we're going to have to offer them something different. And I think we've been in a poor position to do that, partly because we've been very focused on cultural issues, not economic issues. And I have to say, these are my cultural issues. I've worked on race and gender for nearly 40 years. And I think they're really, really important. And I don't agree with the misogyny and the racism that is coming down. And I am deeply alarmed by it. But I also think that if you speak of white working class people as ignorant, as stupid, that you are just fueling the kind of class anger that undercuts our ability to achieve a progressive future for people of color, for women, for anyone.
Well, but the subtext of Hillary Clinton's campaign in the closing weeks was, in fact, that you're stupid if you vote for this guy. Because you know, you're not going to win over people by calling them stupid. And the very arguments that Bill was having with his wife and with Robbie Mook was that in the last week or so, and, you know, this is notwithstanding the interference by the FBI director, but in the last week or so, the low information voters come in and pay attention for the first time. Trump was putting out brilliant commercials in the last week, appealing to the white working class Rust Belt voters. What did Hillary do? She went back to the old tirade of how terrible Trump is. And by extension, the implication is if you vote for him, you're stupid. Which, you know, goes back to that.
Well, and she said, I mean, you know, I think it's important not to dump on Hillary too much. She said the deplorables comment, which was just a very pure expression of the fact that among the progressive elite, white working class voters are often considered to be stupid, racist, whatever. But Obama said something very similar. He said these people are clinging to their guns and religion. This is not a problem, and that's my message, with an individual candidate. This is a problem, structural problem, that the Democratic Party has had now for years. In Obama, we dodged the bullet because he was charismatic, a charismatic 40-year-old man, and he brought the black vote along. Hillary, she's not charismatic, she was not a man, how many times have you heard just what Bill was told, that these white working class voters aren't in our coalition any longer? They're racist, they're sexist, we're not going to go near them. Even to talk to them, to reach out to them, would be selling the soul of the progressive cause. And I guess all I'm saying is, you know, if it's racism people want, we are not going to go there. If it's sexism people want, we are not going to go there. But these people, too, suffer from a structural societal disadvantage. That's our identity. We should be able to make a connection with them in a way that, after all, you know, all Trump is going to deliver is anger. He's not going to deliver white working class jobs. And so it should not be that hard if we make this leap of imagination and say, look, there are many different axes of social disadvantage. Let's think about this one, too. It should not be impossible for us to put together a coalition that includes these people.
Well, just going back to your article, Joan Williams, in the Harvard Business Review, what so many people don't get about the U.S. working class. In many ways, of course, it wasn't just the white working class that voted for Trump. It was also the white middle class. And there have been pretty clear indications that Trump supporters, in fact, polls were done, were the most affluent compared to Hillary Clinton's and certainly Bernie Sanders. And you point out in your article that the Democrats progressives have lavished attention on the poor for over a century. And your sister-in-law worked full-time at Head Start, providing free childcare for poor women while earning so little that she almost couldn't pay for her own. And she resented that, especially the fact that some of the kids' mums did not work and one arrived late to pick up her child carrying shopping bags from Macy's and made your sister-in-law livid. You know, in terms of a lose-lose situation, if you concentrate all your effort on the poor, not on the white working class and on the middle class, obviously America does have an underclass, and it's unacceptable for an advanced, wealthy society to have an underclass. But on the other hand, for example, Obama's signature achievement, which they're about to eviscerate, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has really angered the middle class, because they, again, it fits into that narrative that you're talking about, which is that we're, you know, taking money from the middle class and giving it to the poor.
And Obama, you know, Obama messaged this universal social benefit, focusing on the 20 million who would get health care. And that's another example of how progressives do not understand that providing social benefits for the poor, while not providing subsidies for the people who are just one notch above them, that's very divisive. It's very divisive, and I think that's one of the lessons going forward, that in terms of designing social programs, it may be harder to get universal benefits, but hey, Social Security is still the third rail, whereas those social benefits that are targeted for the poor, although there are good and sufficient reasons why that might make sense, they politically, they don't make sense. And they end up being cut, and they end up also fueling this very unhelpful class dynamic of anger against the poor.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joan Williams.
Okay, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joan Williams, who's a distinguished professor of law and founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. She has an article at the Harvard Business Review, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speculating on the likely choices for the top cabinet posts, Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
And President-elect Donald Trump and his Vice President Mike Pence have been holed up in Trump Tower today going over the final decisions on picking the key members of the cabinet, being the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Treasury, and presumably the Secretary of Defense as well. But those two are the big ones, Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury. At least they sort of indicate where this regime will go. And of course, we've heard that in terms of Secretary of State, the top of the list is former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, a terrifying prospect, frankly. This is not a man known for diplomacy. And then my understanding, and I believe that this is your understanding as well, that Trump may tap the former Goldman Sachs partner Steven Mnuchin as Secretary of the Treasury. So where does it stand now? We're still waiting to hear, obviously.
That's right. And it's been reported also that the transition process itself is in disarray with the termination of some junior staffers for reasons that, again, are unclear. The nightmare turns ever bleaker.
Well, apparently anybody that was associated with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is being purged, and that includes the former chair of the House Intelligence Committee, who was in charge of the intelligence transition, and he was being touted as a possible director of the CIA. So apparently somebody described it within the Trump circle as a Stalin-esque purge. So there does seem to be some disarray at Trump Tower.
That's right. I mean, some of us thought that a certain candidate was unfit. The electorate has decided that this is the person who is our president, and some of us would like to, I would like to suspend this belief that this nightmare is true. However, the initial signs that maybe he could pivot into sanity are not there. at the top of the list. And again, I have no special insight. I'm not given, you know, cell phone calls from Donald Trump or his insiders as to who they're thinking about. My information is as incomplete as the average person's. But yes, it would be dreadful to put somebody, not only a Goldman Sachs partner, which is not per se a terrible thing, but somebody who also is a hedge fund manager who basically profits on the demise of others, who took over IndyMac, a failed savings and loan, and then, you know, went on steroids with foreclosures in the new incarnation of One West. This is just, at least it's not the correct symbol. I mean, if this is the person, then okay, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt when he begins, but we'll be very wary of his first move. And it just seems difficult to believe that his instinct will be for the American good as opposed to whatever it is that his experience has been that leads him to make these decisions. So this is not reassuring at the very least.
Well, Steven Mnuchin has been dubbed the foreclosure machine because of his role in the 2008-2009 crisis and its aftermath. And in October of 2011, protesters marched on his Los Angeles mansion protesting foreclosures. You know, stop taking our homes with some of the signs, etc. So he sounds almost worse than a vulture capitalist.
Yeah, I can't. This is pretty dreadful. It hasn't happened yet. Ideally, it won't happen. Ideally, the president-elect will be hearing people saying this is a dreadful choice. If you're trying to make good on your promise to drain the swamp and to reform Wall Street, this is certainly the exact opposite, that loyalty to you should not be the only criteria by which you choose your inner circle. It should be actual ability to serve the public. But there we go. And if it is Mnuchin, I would like to think that he, at the very least, knows firsthand the bad stuff and knows how to stop it. But again, I think that there are 300 million Americans, and I think there's probably 299.99 million Americans that are better qualified than this guy.
So Mnuchin, of course, ended up, you know, started out, he was at, he's sort of establishment in the sense that he was at Yale with Skull and Bones, and then he became a partner at Goldman Sachs, as was his father before him. He ran a hedge fund. He worked for George Soros, who's the bête noire of the right.
He's a Democrat, which I'm not sure what that means.
But, right. Well, he funded a lot of movies. He bought, as you mentioned, he bought the failed bank IndyMac with John Paulson, the ultimate vulture fund guy. He's hedged. He made, I think, $5.4 billion out of the savings and loan. I mean, out of the 2008 crash. He predicted the crash and profited from it. Which is, some people think that. I'm sure Trump thinks he's a great businessman. He's smart, but. He made a lot of money out of the pain of millions of people, and then of course he's renamed his bank One West, but he just sold his businesses last year to Citigroup for $3.4 billion. So he actually is a real billionaire. We're not entirely sure what kind of a billionaire Donald Trump is, but. I mean, his kids are going to be running his company, and Trump is asking for them to get the highest security clearance in the land so that they can share the most sensitive information on the planet. What do you make of that?
Well, I guess that, you know, the deaths are this one scandal is the tragedy, but if you just pile up so many, our brains can't handle it, and we retire from approbation. My thesaurus is pretty much vacated of the word bad. I don't know what more to say. It's a bad thing. All of these signs, from the election to the initial signs to everything that Donald Trump stands for. We've got an education crisis of students buried in debt, and we have a person who specialized in burying students in debt and not even giving them an education. So the nightmare persists and grows ever worse, it seems.
Well, but this is not just the Trump nightmare. This is also the Paul Ryan nightmare. Paul Ryan today was re-elected as the Speaker. There's a subsequent election, but obviously he got Trump's blessing, and they're going to work together. And Paul Ryan's agenda, even though he's sort of telegenic and seems like a reasonable person and doesn't hurl racist insults around like Trump does, he's got a real hard right, Ayn Rand kind of outlook. So it's not just Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act that they're going to go after with an axe. They're also going to go after Medicaid and Medicare. I mean, it's all on the chopping block. They're only just beginning.
You've hit rock bottom, or we've hit rock bottom, when it's a far-right person who is medically fit that's going to, you know, run the country. That I used to deride divided government, where we really didn't have accountability, because if you didn't like the president, you know, or if you liked the president, you could blame the problems on Congress and so forth. Well, now I'm almost praising divided government. At least it's possible that the fit, far-right people in Congress can at least keep the infirm from going off the rails, at least I hope.
Well, but it's all but inevitable. I mean, they're basically going to save money. And the reason that healthcare costs are out of control is because the healthcare in this country is largely run by insurance companies. And they shouldn't even be in the business, because whatever their overhead is, that's what you get charged extra. So they're kind of like the mafia. You pay a lot extra and you get nothing in return. So this is the plan, though, to basically turn it over to the private sector through vouchers.
No, I think that's right. I mean, healthcare, in my opinion, is a public good. It's something that we all should cause to exist through taxes. I mean, my personal choice is, you know, single payer healthcare, but it has become a commodity subject to what the market will bear, the price the market will bear. And we see that in drug prices being escalated 4,000% when somebody like Shkreli takes over a company. You know, there's no really connection between the cost of providing the health care and the price. And now we have somebody who believes that everything is a deal. Everything is for one party to exercise his leverage and cause himself to perform the best, when in fact public service and government is about something far different. It's about providing services at the least cost, the most people.
Well, the RAND corporations have analyzed Trump's health care reform plan, and they estimate up to 25 million people will be uninsured as a result of it. And that's not to mention the millions that are going to be thrown under the bus if they get rid of Obamacare. So that's what we're going to have. We're going to have a lot of pain in the country. And it all seems so gratuitous. That's, I guess...
I didn't realize that it took something as lofty as the RAND Corporation to analyze a health plan that is shorter than what you can write on a bumper sticker. I thought his plan was pretty short on detail, other than repealing Obamacare.
So, as we mentioned in the beginning, about Naila, we don't know when these big announcements are going to come out. Pence and Trump have been holed up. There's been a lot of disarray in Trump Tower, with the transition team they had to actually wait for Pence's signature, now that they booted out Christie, and all of his anybody tied to him is getting booted out as well, in a fashion that's been described as Stalin-esque. The odds of this Stephen Mnuchin getting the Secretary of Treasury seem pretty high. What about Giuliani, the only guy that he's also the only other person that's been mentioned as a possible next Secretary of State is John Bolton. So, you know, that is like from bad to worse in terms of who.
Right.
So, what's your sense of I mean, and then you've got, of course, you've got Sarah Palin as possible Secretary of the Interior. The nightmare continues. But in terms of the big ones, is there any sense that there's anybody else that could actually, particularly Secretary of State, the idea of having Rudy Giuliani or John Bolton is just so frightening. Have you heard of any other choices? And in Treasury
I've
as well.
I've seen lists. In other words, people talk about Jamie Dimon for Treasury or Jeff Hensarling, the chair of the House Banking Committee or House Financial Services Committee. Again, those people would be far down my list, even if I was told, you know, here, you're a Republican and now this is who the possibilities are. I mean, arguably, Jamie Dimon is a skillful person. He manages a company that has, you know, close to $3 trillion in assets, so presumably he knows a little bit about operations. Jeff Hensarling, however, has not managed a staff. He is the chair of a committee where he's engaged in theatrics, passing bills that never become law. Again, I'm not sure that those are recommendations, but apparently loyalty, and Mnuchin as the finance director for the Trump campaign puts him front and center. Again, I think that's not the best reason to name somebody to head the financial policy making for the country.
And is there a connection with Mnuchin and the really controversial character, Stephen Bannon? They're both ex Goldman Sachs, both made money in the movie business.
Well, I'm pretty much of a hayseed. I did not realize that Breitbart News, where Stephen Bannon is a leader, is one of the most popular websites. I guess I now have to look at that every day because that's where a good deal of America and a good deal of the Trump supporters get their information. It seems pretty hateful, full of nationalism, racism of all kinds. I just can't believe that a person whose job it is to unify the nation would put somebody in there whose very proposition is that we are a nation of whites, skipped apart, that apparently there were people here before my forebears arrived from Europe. Again, the nightmare continues.
Well, but what's scary about Breitbart is not so much what it is now. It's what it will be in a Trump administration. My understanding is that Trump is basically going to cut off the White House press corps, the mainstream press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the main networks. They're not going to get anything. Breitbart's going to get the first bite at the apple on all breaking news that, you know, and if you control the executive branch, you certainly control a lot of breaking news.
Yes, and then spin it through its various lenses of Clorox.
Well, but this has never happened before where you've had a person who's close to the president who's actually running a media operation that's opposed to the mainstream media, which they think, Breitbart thinks that Fox is too moderate. So, you know, the idea that they're going to be getting exclusives on everything and everybody else is going to be, you know, waiting around for sloppy seconds is pretty...
No, you raise perhaps the most chilling point is that our democracy pivots on information, and that information in turn depends on a free media that is collecting information equally, aggressively, cynically, skeptically. We're supposed to ask tough questions of our elected leaders because every couple of years we decide whether or not that we're going to retain them. And now apparently our president is going to filter who it is that explains what he's doing. and therefore it becomes a vicious circle. Arguably, hypothetically, we're not even going to know fully what he's doing, because those who might critically and skeptically report on what he's doing will be banned from collecting that information in the first place.
Well, Bartlett Naylor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's a financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the murderous, foul-mouthed Filipino President Duterte has gone too far.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend.
Nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo, at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, a Tom Dispatch regular who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, among other works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Ian, happy to be back.
And what do you make of this mercurial new president of the Philippines who succeeded in insulting President Obama, the head of the United Nations? He's gone off to China, where he's basically told the Chinese he's going to cut ties with the United States. He's conducting a war on drugs that has brought about international rebukes because it's essentially licensing vigilantes to go out and kill anybody. And it's, I think the death toll now is about 2,500. But now, the very man who persuaded Rodrigo Duterte to run for the Philippines presidency has quit, his mentor and the former president, Fidel Ramos. So that seems like a really strong rebuke, to say the least.
Yeah, it's complex. Any Philippine discussion of Philippine relations with the United States is complex, freighted with ambiguity, imprecision, and doubt. First of all, Duterte is, I think, playing a potentially a risky game. The Philippines has an ambiguous relationship to the United States. The Pew poll of opinion of the United States shows that Filipino approval of the United States is higher than any other nation on the planet, including America itself. In other words, Filipinos love America more than Americans love themselves, if you believe the poll. The Filipinos give the United States a 92% approval rating. Americans give America an 82% approval rating. And it's been that way for a long time. So on the surface, there is a great Filipino romance with America. For working class and middle class Filipinos, getting a child over to the United States as a doctor, a nurse, or a professional is a major aspiration. It's a way up. The largest source of foreign exchange in the Philippines is remittances from overseas workers. There's about 10 or 11 million Filipinos all over the world. A full third of those remittances come from the United States. And educated Filipinos are English-speaking. The biggest industry right now, the biggest single employer in the Philippines are call centers. when you call in about your computer or your refrigerator or whatever it is, you're likely to get routed to somewhere in Metro Manila, and you'll have quite a fluent English speaker on the line helping you with your problem. That is a huge and growing industry in the Philippines, and it reflects the use of English as a medium of instruction at the university level. And then there's basketball. My good heavens. The great Filipino sporting obsession is basketball. The NBA playoffs are bigger than Manila, are bigger in Manila than they are in any other American city. The big college sport is basketball. The big professional sport in the Philippines is the Philippine Basketball Association. The ties are enormous and many. I'll just give you an example. Back in the 1990s, the star of our local high school basketball team, West High, was a guy named Alex Compton. He later went to Cornell, played for Cornell. He wound up as a player in the Philippines. He's now the coach of the Alaska Aces in the Philippine Basketball Association League. He's in the playoffs. He's a very popular figure in the Philippines. And that intertwining of his career in this quintessentially American and Philippine sport is illustrative of the many, many deep ties that bind these two societies together. On the other hand, there's this undercurrent of resentment, in terms of sort of post-memory, as it's called. The Philippines has a traumatic memory of the crushing of the Philippine Republic back in 1898, the brutal four-year pacification the United States conducted of that country, which killed something like 200,000 people in a population that was then only 6 million. In World War II, as a bastion of the United States, as a battleground at the beginning and the end of the war, Manila emerged as the second most heavily damaged city on the entire planet. 1 million Filipinos died in that fighting in a population that was still only 16 million people. And then there were the resentments over the military bases during the Cold War. There were sexual assaults. There were shootings by base guards. And each one of these incidents pointed out that the Philippines really had sacrificed its sovereignty to allow those bases. So in 1991, the Philippine Senate actually voted to terminate the bases agreement and kick us out. Well, it's only been over the last few years that relationship has been rebuilt in the context of the global war on terror. But even then, there was an incident that happened in January of 2015, the Mamasampano massacre, where we think it's CIA. Nobody's quite clear about who the Americans were that were behind this. We're going for the top terrorist target. A guy named Marwan, who's believed to have organized the Bali bombing back in 2002 that killed so many. Over 200 people died in that bombing attack. They had indications that Marwan, in fact, we think it was actually him, Marwan was hiding in a village of Mindanao. The CIA trained a special group of rangers in the Philippine police, sent them into what turned out to be a Muslim massacre. 44 of the troops died. Their funeral was a great national mourning. Americans had never heard of it. This was a huge event in the Philippines, and there was this undercurrent of suspicion that the Americans had once again sent our people to their deaths. So there is that undercurrent of resentment, and that's what Duterte is playing to with all of these outrageous statements. And as for Ramos, Ramos is a man of General Fidel Ramos, the former president of the Philippines in the 1990s. He's a man of considerable dignity, and one thing that people don't remember anymore, of course, is that he's a graduate of West Point, of the U.S. Military Academy of West Point, I think class of 1952. there was a long tradition during the U.S. colonial era, right up until the outbreak of World War II, and then after the war, of Filipino cadets coming from the Philippines, going to West Point, and then going back and rising through the ranks of the Philippine military. And Ramos is one of those, and he's a man of some dignity and considerable restraint. His father was the foreign minister of the Philippines, so he has a long tradition of diplomacy and comportment, and Duterte, I think, has finally gone too far. Ramos, who was the man who persuaded Duterte to run for president earlier this year, Ramos is broken with him, and Ramos is tired. He's outraged by Duterte's constant misbehavior, his insults, his obscenities, and I think he's has fundamental reservations that Duterte is going too far in pushing the United States over the military alliance. You know, there's an old game dating back to, oh, good heavens, back to independence, really in the Marcos era. Marcos was brilliant at playing the relationship. During the Marcos era in the 1970s, the U.S. had these massive military bases that were very important during the Cold War at Subic Bay and at Clark Field Air Force Base. Huge bases. The biggest overseas naval base the United States had at that time was at Subic Bay. And so, on the one hand, Marcos was himself a veteran of World War II, fighting on the side of the United States, who'd received veteran benefits from the U.S. Veterans Administration. On the other hand, he was a real nationalist. So he had his daughter, Aimee, who was head of kind of the Philippine edition of the Hitler Youth for the Marcos dictatorship, with her legions of young people marching and chanting anti-American slogans in front of the U.S. Embassy right on the edge of Manila Bay on Rojas Boulevard. At the same time, his wife, Imelda Marcos, was cozying up to the Americans, and he, too, suggesting that some more rent for the bases might be in order. So Duterte, is, if he's playing it that way, that's okay, because that maximizes the Philippines' self-interest. But if he pushes it too hard, there's always the possibility of a military coup. And that could happen. You know, it's happened several times in recent Philippine past. Duterte could find himself, you know, at the wrong end of the Philippine military.
Well, on October the 1st, General Ramos wrote a column in the Manila Bulletin where he questioned why Duterte felt it necessary to alienate the United States, quoting Fidel Ramos, "Are we throwing away decades of military partnership, tactical proficiency, compatible weaponry, predictable logistics, and soldier-to-soldier camaraderie just like that on Duterte's say-so?" So that sort of sounds a bit like a precursor to some kind of almost a signal to the military. Apparently, Senator Ben Cardin has blocked the sale of M4 assault rifles to the Philippine police because of these human rights abuses in Duterte's drug war. At this point, are there questions going on in the Philippines about this tilt to China? Because it seems like the Chinese basically are playing a game where they're no longer being so aggressive over the Scarborough Shoals, which is about 100 miles off the Philippines, which they occupied, and now they're sort of letting Filipino fishermen go there, but they haven't given it up. That seems like a very cheap gesture on the part of China if they can end up getting the Philippines to kick out the Americans. That would be quite a coup, would it not, for the Chinese?
Oh, yes. But really, it's the literal. It's the line of islands offshore Asia, Japan through the Philippines all the way down to Australia. That's the real anchor on the eastern end of this axial point of control of the Eurasian landmass. And among these three powers, the Philippines is the one that's most immediately sighted right on the shores of the South China Sea. And back in 2014, the Obama administration negotiated with the preceding Philippine government under President Aquino and Noynoy Aquino, and they reached an agreement that the United States would have access to five major Philippine bases, that the U.S. could have a cantonment or facilities and equipment inside these five bases. Several of them are right astride the South China Sea, giving the U.S. a counterweight to those seven or eight bases that the Chinese have built in islands, both the Paracels and particularly the Spratlys in the South China Sea. So if Duterte ends those joint military maneuvers, and if he kicks the U.S. out, if he doesn't allow them to actually activate and make use of those five military bases, that would be a major blow, kind of removing that critical middle piece in this chain of islands from Japan through Okinawa, the Philippines, down to Australia. And it would greatly weaken the U.S. position. Moreover, Duterte's term is 6 years. He's just started in office. If that persisted throughout the whole of the 6 years, that would turn China's de facto occupation of those islands into a kind of an undeniable geopolitical reality that wouldn't change very quickly. And that would leave the United States and the U.S.-led alliance of Asian and Pacific nations in a very weak position vis-a-vis China.
Well, but the Filipino military itself, if that's an issue here, and if you suggested, as you did, Alfred McCoy, that there could be a military coup against Duterte if his behavior continues to outrage people like General Fidel Ramos, it would seem to me that given that the Philippine Navy is basically, I don't think they even have active warships. The Air Force, I don't believe it even has an operational aircraft anymore. I mean, it's a total paper tiger, isn't it, the Philippine military?
Yeah, well, this is where the three-part alliance comes into play. Japan has got a major program right now that they're launching. The Prime Minister of Japan, Prime Minister Abe, is very much a leader of the resurgent Japanese military. He's almost, he's basically rewritten the pacifist constitution in a functional sense to allow the Japanese self-defense forces to engage in military operations beyond Japan, a kind of defense in depth, if you will, so they can operate in support of allies. And they've said that for the first time. He's got a five-year program for a significant increase in the size of the Japanese military. He's encouraged and gotten the stationing of more U.S. forces in Japan, and he's reaching out to the Philippines and providing potentially fighters and military aid to the Philippines as a part of the reconstruction of their forces. And so there's lateral pressure from Japan on the Philippines to back away from China because, of course, Japan has its own disagreement, territorial disagreement, over the East China Sea, particularly the Senkaku Islands, little chips of rock in the East China Sea that Japan claims and China claims as well. So there's a very similar dispute there. Japan has not backed off from the confrontation. Japan has become more resolutely allied with the United States. And the United States has actually presided over with Japan a rewriting of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty to allow this changing role for Japanese military forces. So it's a complex puzzle. And then, of course, Australia is firmly on the side of the United States. Australia has allowed the permanent basing of heavy U.S. equipment near Darwin. A Marine battalion is now in Darwin. U.S. ships can anchor at Darwin and use that as a port, just like they can use ports in Japan, and until recently, they could use Subic Bay in the Philippines. So it's a complex three-way arrangement here. But if the Philippines drops out, that's a critical defeat for the United States.
Well, Alfred McCoy, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who's a Tom Dispatch regular, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, among other works. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.